Thanks, Greg. Good afternoon, Council. Thanks for being with us this afternoon. If at any point you have trouble hearing us or seeing us, just raise your hand and let us know. So this is case number 22-1879, Vindel Medina versus the Attorney General of the United States. Ms. Kane, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Respectfully, I believe we requested that the oral arguments proceed with Mr. Newman arguing the jurisdiction issue first.
That's fine. Okay. Mr. Newman.
We have a real problem with jurisdiction, do we? I mean, you all admit that the case is not barred, that we can hear it on the merits. You have some differences of opinion, but that's something, if we decided it would be dictum, and do we really want to spend our time worrying about dictum? The question I think is, when we send the case back, should we send the case back? Can we affirm the decision on the merits of the BIA, or should we send it back? And I would focus the argument on that point, frankly, myself.
Understood. But Mr. Newman, your views?
Thank you, Judge Restrepo. So I'm here to argue only about the jurisdictional point. I'm happy to do so if the court would like me to, and if the court would prefer to move to the merits, certainly happy to turn it over to Ms. Kane.
But what is the jurisdictional issue in doubt here? You both admit that the petition is timely. And that being the only thing of issue in this case, anything else we say would be purely hypothetical or dictum, wouldn't it be?
Well, let me ask Mr. McManus, do you agree that everybody's on the same page, so to speak, with respect to jurisdiction?
Thank you, Your Honor. I do agree with that in terms of we're talking about timeliness and finality of the agency's decision here. The court's jurisdiction really was never in question. The question is, has petitioner filed a timely petition with regard to the withholding only determination? And again, Judge Roth is absolutely right. The parties are all in agreement on that. But I do think it's important for the court to address that issue because it has not yet issued a precedential decision. It has its unpublished decision in Duenas adopting the party's position.
We don't give advisory opinions. If the issue isn't before us, the court, any decision we give in that would be dictum, and it would be no more influential than your non-precedential opinion, right?
Is it just because there's no controversy, Your Honor, or simply because
Well, it's not that because there's no controversy. In this case, there's no need to have a controversy because everyone agrees that the petition is timely.
But that's true, Your Honor, but that issue has now divided the circuit courts. And so for this court to address it,
appropriate case must come up before this court before we decide it. But how can we decide an issue that is not relevant to this court just because you want to hear from the Third Circuit?
But again, Your Honor, I'm not sure that it's accurate to say that it's not relevant. Clearly, whether the court can entertain a timely petition is a fundamental threshold question.
You are arguing that the opinion is timely. No one is arguing that the petition for review is timely. No one's arguing that it isn't timely. So I don't see where there is any opposition to be dealt with.
Well, maybe if I could get in on this, you know, I mean, what we're dealing with here is it seems that there's two tiers to the argument. The first tier is one of statutory construction. This circuit has issued two different NPOs on statutory construction. And we've got a circuit split going on in terms of what constitutes finality and what doesn't. It may be that the parties now in this one instance agree on a statutory construction, but our duty, like the duty of all courts, is to say what the law is. And when it comes to a statute, I don't think we can just accept what the parties agree a statute should mean. And so the first thought is, even if we do begin, so if there's any doubt that both parties are kind of, or all the parties are telling us something about statute that's not in, that's an inconsistent or an improper reading of the statute, then we get to the primary importance of the jurisdictional issue. Because if it just so happens that a withholding order is not when we start finality, a denial of a withhold, a relief on a denial of withholding only proceeding is not when we start the clock, and that we should start the clock at an earlier time, either the reinstatement order or the original order, then the question becomes of very big significance of jurisdiction. Because
but nobody wants to start it at an earlier time. So why should we be bothering with this issue in this case? Shouldn't this issue await a case where it is an issue that is relevant to the decision, rather than just a desire to decide this issue because a bunch of other circuits have?
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I beg your pardon if that question was meant for me or Judge Phipps. I might just offer that the reason it's important is because, as Judge Phipps pointed out, we're talking about statutory construction, and the court has an obligation to convince itself of its own jurisdiction at the threshold. And again, although the parties here are simpatico, this issue itself has divided the circuit courts. And to your point about it not being relevant in this
particular problem, not your problem.
Perhaps, Your Honor, that's fair. But the point being, it's unlikely, it's extremely unlikely that this will ever become a problem for the court, because the parties are in agreement. The government has now consistently taken the position it is taking in this case in every circuit court. We've lost that issue. The parties collectively have lost that issue at least twice. But the government and petitioner's counsel and the amici are all in agreement across the circuits. And so just because this case may not have a live controversy with respect to that discrete issue, it doesn't mean that it's not an important question for the court to answer in this case. And I will point out, Your Honor, this court sat for another argument in November addressing the same issue and has held multiple cases in abeyance for a decision in that case. I believe, Judge Roth, you were on that panel. That's in Strepo, that case that we cited in our brief. And again, so I don't know that it's fair to say that this issue is not ripe for consideration in the context of this case, simply because the parties are in agreement. I'm sorry, I'm not sure if I'm connecting with you.
I think I understand your position.
I mean, I've made my point. Why don't we go ahead and
I think that Judge Roth, Phipps, and I can untie this knot amongst ourselves. But why don't we go to the merits then? How about we go to the merits? Ms. Kane.
Certainly, Your Honor. Good afternoon. May it please the court. Before I begin speaking to the merits of this case, I would like to request to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Sure.
And actually, let me actually clarify then, if we're not hearing from Mr. Newman, I had handed over a portion of my time to him to address the jurisdictional issue. So I am going to assume that
I'd at least like to hear a little bit on the jurisdictional issue at some point in time, because I think that if this court rules against the consensus of the parties on what the statute means, and we're allowed to do that, that's not an Article III case or controversy thing, then the only thing that's going to save you on the merits is to say that the statute's not jurisdictional. And so I think that it's very common for a court to look at option 1A for the parties and then option 1B. So I don't know that this is the sort of instance, we can go in whatever order, but I do think that there's merit in teasing out what constitutes both option 1A and 1B in terms of past the victory when you're client.
Well, I'll tell you what, Judge Phipps, if you have jurisdictional issues, I'm assuming Mr. Newman's in a position to answer those questions. So why don't we just go ahead? We have time this afternoon, so why don't we just move forward? And I'm sure that Mr. Newman and Mr. McManus can answer the jurisdictional issues that Judge Phipps has. Does that work for you, Judge Phipps?
That's fine.
Great. Well, thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Harrison Newman of Covington & Burling as court-appointed amicus curiae. We have two related jurisdictional arguments in addressing this court's amicus appointment order. First, reinstatement orders become final for purposes of judicial review under Section 1252A1 only at the conclusion of withholding-only proceedings. And second, Section 1252B1's time bar imposes a non-jurisdictional claim processing rule. I'll start with finality, which is the order we used in our brief. For three reasons, reinstatement orders become final for purposes of judicial review under 1252A1 only at the conclusion of withholding-only proceedings. First, this is the plain and ordinary meaning of the statutory text final as it is used in 1252A1. Second, this understanding is the only one that harmonizes the INA's statutory structure as a coherent scheme. And third, this is the existing understanding of finality for purposes of judicial review across analogous immigration contexts. The strong presumption of judicial review of agency action yet further confirms this meaning. First, turning to the text, 1252A1 provides for judicial review of a final order of removal. As this court has held, a reinstatement order is an order of removal for purposes of judicial review under 1252A1.
But this court after we held that, though, you know, the Supreme Court came out with, or at least, you know, the Supreme Court's recently come out with this Johnson case, which seems to suggest that final orders of removal are distinct from withholding only or denials of withholding only relief. That's Justice Alito. He is pretty emphatic about that. And so if final isn't the key word, but order of removal is the key phrase, such that order of removal is distinct from a withholding only order, then really your text breaks down.
So to be clear, we don't argue that a withholding only order is a final order of removal. What we argue is that the reinstatement order, which this court has recognized is an order of removal, becomes final at the conclusion of the withholding only proceedings. Now, we take that from the text, we take that from the broader context of the INA and from the existing understanding of finality in immigration contexts. So first, I think that the definition of final does ultimately sort of control the analysis here for that very reason, which is that it's the finality of the order of removal, which is the reinstatement order. And so we look first to the statutory definition of final, but that doesn't address reinstatement orders. This court has held in Kuzam that the definition of finality for purposes of deportation orders doesn't control the analysis of finality for an order of removal. And the statutory definition ties finality of the deportation order to the end of the BIA's possible review period, but there is no possible BIA review period for a reinstatement order. So Kuzam recognized based on that, the statutory definition of finality doesn't exclude other triggers for finality. And here we're arguing that indeed, as Kuzam previewed, this is another instance of a trigger for finality beyond that definition that doesn't apply here. Now, similarly, the regulatory definition also doesn't apply as we discuss in our briefs. So in the absence of an applicable statutory and regulatory definition, courts give a statutory term its plain ordinary meaning. We look to the dictionary definition of final, the definition ordinarily applied to agency action, and the civil litigation definition. And all of those understandings, which we discussed at greater length in our brief, suggest that finality occurs whenever there's no additional agency adjudication yet to occur. So that would be at the conclusion of the withholding-only proceedings.
So the most obvious definition, at least to me, would be the APA's definition and the Bennett v. Speer articulation of the APA's definition, because this is still an administrative proceeding. It's not civil litigation yet. It's not necessarily a dictionary thing. But there, the key phrase was final agency action. And agency action encompasses a lot of action. Agencies can do many, many regulatory things. And so when you want to look at finality, you begin to look at the consummation of their decision-making and rights and obligations being determined. But the modifier in 1252B is not final agency action. The modifier in 1252B is final order. It's much narrower. So why should we use the APA's incredibly broad definition that is trying to deal with all sorts of agency action to something that doesn't say agency action? It just says final order of removal.
So I think this ultimately goes to the nature of what a removal order actually is. And there's sort of two determinations at play here, and they play out differently in different contexts and in different cases. So the first determination that the agency makes is that of removability, which is whether the alien may be removed from the United States. And that determination has nothing to do with any specific country. And so when there's a final agency determination of removability, that's when, as the court held in Johnson v. Guzman-Chavez, I refer to it as Guzman-Chavez, but that is when the agency has concluded its determination on removability. And so at that moment, the mandatory detention statute kicks in. There's the second determination then, which is what's ultimately relevant here when the full agency process concludes, which is that country-specific portion of it. Now, we tie it to the statutory withholding claim because I'm happy to talk about Nasrallah. Nasrallah sort of takes the CAT claim into a different area. So the CAT claim doesn't affect finality for purposes of judicial review, and we don't argue that it does. But the statutory withholding claim is distinct from the CAT claim for a couple of reasons. So first, the statutory scope of judicial review of final removal orders includes statutory withholding claims. And this is a key point that the Second and Fourth Circuits, which are the outlier circuits on this circuit split, they didn't even cite the provision I'm about to discuss here, 1252b4, and they didn't address sort of how their interpretation accommodates this provision. I think that was an oversight there that I'd like to talk about right now. So 1252b is entitled Requirements of Review of Orders of Removal, and it supplies various requirements with respect to review of an order of removal under A1, A1 being the final order of removal. B4 defines the scope and standard for review of an order of removal to include statutory withholding terms. Now, it does so in an oblique way by referencing 1231b3c, 1231b3 being the statutory withholding provision. No doubt, it's not the most direct reference. But as we know, as this court is well aware, the INA uses cross-references in a variety of ways, as perhaps not a model of clarity at some points. Nonetheless, by referencing that very statutory withholding provision, the INA is expressly stating that the scope of judicial review includes statutory withholding claims. And so that contrary definition of finality that the Second and Fourth Circuits have offered, by cutting off judicial review of statutory withholding claims, they're effectively contravening the congressionally defined scope of judicial review here. Now, it's important to also note, just for tying it all together here, that statutory withholding claims are able to be reviewed here alongside excuse me, Your Honor, I see my time is up.
If you can just finish up this line here, and then we'll ask Mr. McMaster his insight.
Great, happy to do that. So the INA zipper clause allows this court, and in fact sort of consolidates review and requires this court to review that distinct statutory withholding determination, which itself is not a final order of removal, alongside that final order of removal, which is the reinstatement order. So they sort of consolidate together and they form a single package in one petition for review before this court.
Mr. McManus?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I will certainly just piggyback on everything Mr. Newman said, but and also try and address some of Judge Phipps' questions by specifically pointing out that Duenas, again, the unpublished decision discussed in our supplemental brief, addresses a lot of these issues. And it's footnote 6 where the court drew an analogy between the APA and the Bennett v. Speer definition of finality and the consensus view among the circuit courts about finality in the judicial review context for purposes of these sort of unique administrative proceedings that flow from reinstatement decisions. And the difference, I think, in the sort of problem, again, to sort of piggyback on something Mr. Newman said, with the Second and Fourth Circuits analysis is that they focus myopically on a definition of administrative finality, which this court has recognized can be and is different than the definition of finality for purposes of judicial review under 1252. Again, that's discussed in Duenas, and it's also discussed in our brief. And so what you're left with, Your Honor, is essentially a line of cases, dating back about a decade that have established this consensus view of finality in this context. And this court's precedent basically would have to be undermined or overturned by Johnson or Nasrallah in order for the court to diverge from that. And as we explain, and I think as the amici explain and petitioner explained in our supplemental briefing, neither Nasrallah nor Guzman-Chavez answer the relevant finality question that's presented before the court in this case. And again, essentially, the Second and Fourth Circuits have overread those decisions and try to sort of by proxy apply the definition of finality that Mr. Newman discussed at the outset of his presentation, which doesn't necessarily align with these, again, sort of unique expedited administrative proceedings, whether it be reinstatement or the final administrative removal orders that are sometimes issued in cases involving aggravated felonies. And so ultimately, the government's position is that the status quo is neither broken nor in need of fixing.
Can I just ask a question here? Is there any tension between our holdings in Bonilla and in Cousin? You know, Bonilla footnote 4 suggests that a withholding only order is a final order. And then Cousin seems to suggest that the definition of the deportation orders, the finality of deportation orders, is not the same thing that we're going to use for the analysis and a finality of an order of removal. So, you know, are we in a situation where if Bonilla began to rely on something that Cousin said it couldn't, can we still follow Bonilla?
I'm not sure and to be clear, Your Honor, Bonilla was a reasonable fear case. I think that's right. And Galeas Figueroa, which I think is one of the more recent decisions from this court, is a withholding only case. But I think those decisions, if I'm not mistaken, don't really elaborate on the sort of determination that those are reviewable final orders. And to your point of building on Cousin, they may sort of elide the distinction between a final order as it's defined in the statute and a order that becomes final with further administrative proceedings. And I think, again, this goes back to the point that these unique sort of processes afforded to, you know, certain subcategories of non-citizens aren't neatly fit into the sort of finality or removal order box, right? You know, that definition at 1101A47 that talks about final orders of removal was enacted 2 years before this sort of reinstatement and reasonable fear withholding only proceedings were created by statute and then regulation. And so there's really not a correlation between the two. I think those cases, cases like Bonilla and Galeas Figueroa are good enough for what they are, which is to say, you know, to sort of show the court's understanding, you know, in line with the consensus that a decision following a reinstatement order only becomes final and reviewable once the agency proceedings have completed. Mr. Newman talked about the culmination of proceedings. And again, this goes back to your Judge Phipps, your question about the APA's definition. It's only when all of the agency proceedings have ended that you can say a decision is final for purposes of review. And this court's current view and the consensus view, other than the two outlier circuits, aligns with that understanding. Here we are saying that the court should take review of a decision that is ultimately final once everything is done, once the agency has completed its review. And in the unique context of reinstatement orders, that is either when in the case of a non-citizen who expresses a fear of returning to his home country, it's when the reasonable fear of withholding only proceedings end.
So just to tease this out, you're talking about the two outlier circuits. We have an NPO split a little bit in our circuit too, but a little of this because the government changed its mind. You used that. So, I mean, at one level, maybe you convinced two circuits or at least one circuit of a view. I don't know if that's what you argued in front of the Second Circuit. You argued the same thing in the second.
Yeah, to be clear, Your Honor, and that's a really good point. Bhaktapati Patel comes out of nowhere. Neither the government nor petitioner's counsel in that case argued in favor of the court's position. No one argued that Guzman Chavez or Nasrallah changed the outcome. And Bhaktapati Patel was a divergence from Second Circuit precedent that had long since followed this consensus view.
But then you picked up on it and argued it a few times. The government did, not you maybe personally, but then you argued that times. Then you had a change of heart, and now you're recognizing that as an outlier. Is that right?
Yeah, that's fair, Your Honor. No, and again, Bhaktapati Patel was the decision that sort of precipitated this whole thing. And that's a fair description of how the government sort of proceeded in certain cases, including this one. At the outset, we picked up on the Bhaktapati Patel position. advocated for it, but nevertheless, I would point out, nevertheless, argued that the court should still exercise jurisdiction in these individual cases. And, you know, that for lots of reasons, fundamental fairness being the key. But then obviously, yes, in consultation with the Office of Solicitor General, the government reversed course, as it were, and has, but has now taken consistent positions in every, almost every circuit, as far as I know. That's, again, reflective of what we're taking, the position we're taking here.
So, Mr. McMahon,
I would call that more a change of mind than a change of heart.
I beg your pardon, Judge Roth. I'm sorry, I missed the first part.
I would call that more a change of mind rather than a change of heart.
That's fair, Your Honor. I think the government wanted to make sure that its position was appropriate and consistent. And although we initially seemed convinced or sold by the reasoning in Bhaktivedanta, we did change our minds and have now advocated a position that's more consistent with what Mr. Newman and Ms. Kane have argued.
So, Mr. McManus, I take it you have no issues with the way Duaneus was resolved?
No, not at all, Your Honor. Not at all. And I think that there is a statement in my supplemental brief that makes clear that the court should adopt that as the law of the third.
Right. Thank you very much. Why don't we turn to the merits, Ms. Kane?
Sure. Thank you, Your Honor. And again, I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Sure.
Thank you. So Alyssa Kane representing the petitioner, Mr. Moreland Vidal-Medina. Mr. Vidal-Medina was severely beaten, shot at, threatened with death as a teenager, and initially fled under as in 2012. 7 years later, he returned after his first order of deportation and was nearly immediately identified and targeted again for harboring.
I think we're all pretty familiar with the facts. Let me ask you a question. Is it true that there can be only one central issue, or can there be more than one issues of fear that can play a role in saying, I don't want to go back? Can it be both the beating and the family history, or can it just be the one?
I think it can certainly be both, Your Honor. I think that the petitioner in this case can have many reasons to fear returning to Honduras. I think you're getting to whether or not his family membership was one central reason for his fear of return. If his fear of return is based solely on his beating at the hands of gang members when he was 13 years old, their express reasoning at the time that they told him was that he was no longer working for him. However, if his fear of return is also based on multiple threats to himself and his family member by gang members expressly telling him that his family members were snitches, that they had knew that his family members had made reports about them to the police, and that was a reason for them to threaten him and with death, then I think that is also a central reason for him to fear return to Honduras.
Is it your position that it was clear error for the BIA to say there is just one central reason and that's all we will consider?
That's right, Your Honor. Certainly this court's precedent has held that at least one central reason is sufficient to show nexus. If the respondent's particular social group, the threats were based on the respondent's particular social group, which the judge found his family membership was a particular social group in this case. If threats based on that ground are at least one central reason, then the respondent has established nexus to a particular ground.
The governing standard of review is the substantial evidence standard, right? And so, that's a very agency friendly definition. It basically says, look, you know, are we left, you know, is there a way to trace a pathway to the agency's finding that's rational? And that's how I understand it. If you can trace a way to get where they got on the record before them, that's rational. You may disagree with it. You may think it's not persuasive at all, But if all we're doing is coming down and wanting to reweigh facts in a certain order or do something like that, then that's not something that just kind of in the division of labor among the review process that we get a chance to do. And so substantial evidence is remarkably deferential to agencies. And so here, the agency on, you know, I think two occasions, you know, on its two tiers of review said, yeah, we actually can chart a path here where there's no withholding and there's no cat. So how does what they do not meet the substantial evidence standard?
I understand that, Your Honor, and I do agree that the standard is extremely deferential to the agency. The standard is no reasonable fact finder could conclude that the agency's factual findings were correct. I think in this case, the agency was disregarding substantial portions of the evidence in this case in order to reach the conclusion that there was only one central reason and that one central reason was the respondent's refusal to participate in gang activities.
If we were going to remand this,
also
that, go ahead, Jane. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Didn't they imply also that the rule was that we will focus on the one central reason. We won't consider the other reasons.
I do believe that is part of what the BIA was saying, that I don't know if their interpretation of the facts in this case was that the respondent's family membership was tangential at best. If that's the case, then that would not constitute one central reason, but their reasoning disregards the idea that there could be another central reason in this case that is not based on the respondent's refusal to participate in gang membership.
So at one level,
go ahead, Judge.
So maybe if your challenge is, I mean, Judge Roth opened this somewhat early on by saying, you know, can there be multiple central reasons that would qualify as one central reason? And if what you're saying, though, is the agency's disregard wasn't so much of disregard of facts, I think we can see that they considered a lot of facts. I mean, I think they assessed a lot of things, they heard from people. But if you say that maybe they were misguided because they thought there was only one central reason, then that might not be so much a mistake. There could only be one, an individual central reason instead of multiple. That's more a dispute of law than a dispute of fact. So is your challenge really one in law, or is it grounded in fact?
If the BIA's understanding is that there is only one central reason, and I think that is a valid reading of their decision, that the central reason as opposed to at least one central reason, right? And if that's the case, I think this case would certainly be required to be remanded for a reassessment, because this court's precedent has certainly established that there can be more than one central reason for persecution.
It would be an issue of law rather than an issue of fact. That saying that there can only be one central reason is an issue of law rather than an issue of fact. So it's an issue that we now on the Court of Appeals can consider, whereas if it were simply a factual finding, that is not the area where our review extends.
That's right, Your Honor. And, you know, yes.
Ms. Kim, what did they ignore? Could you just point us to some of the evidence in the record that you suggest they ignored?
Sure, Your Honor. So I think there are several instances in the testimony that the respondent made it clear that his family had been clearly labeled as people who report to the police, people who report gang activity to the police, snitches, he called them. And that is at 145. And 369. So 369 was the original merits hearing. In this case, he specifically stated that his grandmother was killed because she reported to the police. The police made her report public, and the gang members therefore became aware of her report, which is a reasonable consequence of the police making a report like that public. She reported the murder of her nephew of her son to the police, and they made her report public, and she was killed several days later. The following page 370 in the testimony, there is Mr. Vindel Medina states that when they attempted to return to the family's home to collect belongings, gang members refused to allow them to collect the family's belongings, said that the family was all snitches and that they knew what they had done. I do just want to point out, this also ties into the respondent's cat argument, which I also believe is not a reasonable determination that the underwritten authorities did not acquiesce or consent to the torture or harm of the respondent and his family members. The judges and the BIA's conclusion in this case that because the underwritten government has attempted to remediate their police force, that they have made some strides in lessening the corruption of their police forces, means that they cannot possibly acquiesce or consent in this case. And the judges and the BIA's requirement, apparently, that the respondent make his own individual police report in order to qualify for cat protection. I think that is just against this court's precedent. I think that's against the weight of the evidence. And I certainly think that the apparent requirement that the respondent make a police report should not be allowed to stand. The respondent's family members made police reports on three separate occasions, and on all three occasions, they experienced consequences.
How much earlier were those police reports?
Sure, Your Honor. So the first police report was in 2012. Was very early on. That was in 2005, I believe, when the respondent was a very small child. That's when the grandmother made her first police report.
I think she spoke to the police in July of 2003.
Years later, that was in 2012, his cousin made a report to the police about extortion threats that he was receiving. Around the same year, the respondent's mother, Mr. Vindel Medina's mother made a police report regarding Mr. Vindel Medina's cousin's murder. And at that point, the Mr. Vindel Medina claims that's when the gang became aware again that he was still alive, that he was called to their attention again. And at that point, he fled.
But then he returns to Honduras, right?
That's right, Your Honor. He returned 7 years later. And within months of his return, he was again targeted for harm.
But your position, I guess, is what was here? He returns like circa 2019. Do I have this roughly right? Something like this. Yeah. And so your position is that the reports made by different people who are his family members in 2003, 2012, and then 2012 or 2013 obviate the need for him to file a police report after he leaves the country and returns about 7 years later in 2019. The answer is the police should just know. He doesn't need to make a report, and we can just infer acquiescence at that point in time because of the reports in 03, 12, and 12 or 13.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not saying that the police would certainly have ignored a report, or I don't think that's the inference that we need to draw here. I think the inference is that it was reasonable for Mr. Vindel Medina to be afraid of making a police report, because there is no indication in anything that has been presented to the court of the country that corruption has lessened to the point that the same thing would not happen. I don't think it was reasonable to ask him to risk making a police report, because that making the police report in the past directly led to the harm of his family.
Was he living in a different part of Honduras in 2019? He wasn't La Ceiba anymore, was he?
That's correct. He had moved to Santa Barbara at that point. It's a different city.
And so if he's in San, so in the previous reports were made to the La Ceiba authorities, right? Not Santa Barbara or anybody else like that. And so the assumption is that we're going to make, so the rule is that because the La Ceiba police may have taken no action, or I think he has strong words, it amounted to a death threat, right? There's something along those lines, he says, to report it to the La Ceiba police. I guess now we're supposed to say that in 2019, we know, and that there's not substantial evidence that would suggest that there was, I guess there was acquiescence. We know, we can say, despite the substantial evidence standard, there was acquiescence by the Santa Barbara police that would be a death threat to him. That seems like the holding you're asking for.
Well, Your Honor, I think, first of all, I think part of that question is, does the Honduran police divide administratively at that level? Like, is there such administrative division that there's really any significant difference between reporting to police who are physically located in La Ceiba versus police who are physically located in Santa Barbara? They're all part of the same national police force. And I think that the...
I think the country conditions report suggests that some cities are much more corrupt than others, right? I mean, what San Pedro Sula is supposed to be really bad, from what I understand. I think La Ceiba's not quite as bad as San Pedro Sula. And so we know that there is variation, regional variation in Honduras. And in fact, sometimes one of the criteria that courts look to determine whether or not things can happen is the possibility of relocating to a different region. So on substantial evidence review, like, why isn't it just, you know, why can't we chart a rational course to why the agency would deny cat relief when it would say your last report was, you know, 7 years earlier to a different police department in a different region? We, you know, without going to the police again, we can't validate that it would have the same death threat consequences as you may, even if we believe you earlier, that it would this go around.
Well, I think the question then is it really reasonable for somebody in the petitioner's shoes to believe that it would be safe in the same in the way that you're suggesting, when there's no way to know until after you make the police report whether or not it will have deadly consequences? If it happens in some cities and it doesn't happen in other cities, the way to know that is to take the risk, is to enter into the lottery, as we put it in our brief, of whether or not the police department that you're reporting to, the specific office that you're reporting to, has corrupt agents, whether or not the specific department that you're reporting to has people who are on the gang's payroll, because there is substantial evidence that there are police officers throughout the country who are engaging in corrupt activities and who are abetting the gangs.
And the country conditions report, I think, also suggests that the Honduran government is taking efforts against corruption. It's trying to ameliorate that situation. So are we supposed to, you know, we aren't going to disregard that too, are we?
I think that there have been anti-corruption efforts at various times throughout Honduras's history, and none of them have significantly improved the situation. I mean, between what happened in 2012 and what's happening at the time of the respondents' merits hearing in 2022, when we were compiling all of our country conditions reports, corruption is still a significant problem in Honduras. And the efforts that they've been taking over the last, you know, decade or two to address those issues have not significantly improved the situation on the ground.
So, where is your client right now?
My client is currently, to my knowledge, he's currently located in Honduras. This court denied his stay of removal back when we first petitioned for that, and the respondent elected not to request reconsideration. He had at that point been detained for a very significant amount of time. He had been detained for over 2 years at that point. In federal custody and then in ICE custody. He was serving a reentry sentence for 9 months and then was in ICE custody throughout his removal proceedings up until the BIA's final decision. the record also shows he has pretty significant mental health issues that he was dealing with. He was very depressed, and he elected not to fight his deportation.
Understood. So I'm sorry, unless Judge Phipps has another question, why don't we hear from Mr. McManus? Judge Phipps, I didn't mean to cut you off there.
No, I'm good. Thank you very much.
Judge Roth?
Nothing further.
And I believe my time actually is up. I
apologize. We'll hear from you in rebuttal. Mr. McManus?
Thank you again, Your Honor, and may it please the court. I do believe that with regard to both withholding of removal and CAT protection, this is strictly a substantial evidence question. Those are fact-based determinations that the court can only reverse if the record compels a contrary conclusion. This is not a case in which the board ostensibly ignored any relevant evidence. Again, the court applies a presumption of regularity and presumes that the board and the IJ reviewed all of the evidence presented unless the record compellingly suggests otherwise. There's nothing like that here. More importantly, with respect to the legal issue that Judge Roth asked about and that Ms. Cain raised, the board cites the one central reason standard multiple times in its decision, as does the immigration judge. There's no confusion here about the possibility of mixed motives, but that petitioner failed to meet his burden of establishing that family membership or any other protected ground was in fact one central reason. In order to satisfy that standard, a one central reason must be both a but-for cause and not subordinate or tangential to other stated or other obvious reasons. Here, there's no, and at most, the board's determination is that kinship was incidental or tangential to the other stated reasons that are borne out by the record. There's no compelling proof that petitioner was targeted because of family relationship per se, or that family status centrally motivated the gang to act. The intent there must, and this is based on board precedent and this court's decision in Phelan, the persecutor's intent there must be to overcome the protected characteristic of the family membership. This is a quote from LEA, which I think really sums up the government's position on nexus. If the persecutor would have treated the applicant the same if the protected characteristic of the family did not exist, then the applicant has not established a claim on this ground. And in this case, obviously we're focused on exactly what happened in the petitioner himself, but even in the context of what happened to his other family members, the record reveals that everyone was targeted because of what they did, not because of who they are. And that's why the family membership claim fails here. Again, you talk about the context, the uncle in 2003 killed for refusing recruitment. The grandmother killed for reporting that to the police and being, I guess, victimized in a way, you know, making that report public. The cousin, the taxi driver, killed later for refusing to pay extortion and reporting to the police. Petitioner himself, when he discusses the initial beating, which occurred again only after he refused to continue being an errand boy for the gang, he said, and this is quoting from his testimony, they told me, if you're not with us, you're against us, you're useless. The reason for targeting him was because he refused to continue cooperating. And that type of motivation is what tracks every instance of alleged persecution in this case, whether it's against petitioner himself or his family members. There's no question that the gangs, at least according to petitioner's credible testimony, there's no question that the gangs may have marked the family as a group of snitches. But the question is whether that animated their decision to act, whether that was the motivation for seeking the alleged persecution. And again, coming back to Judge Phipps' point, the question for the court is only whether a reasonable adjudicator could have found as the agency did. If so, then the record cannot possibly compel a contrary conclusion. And it was certainly reasonable for the agency here to decide that whatever else underlay the original decision to act, petitioner's persecution or alleged persecution was not centrally motivated by his kinship. And ultimately, that's dispositive of the withholding claim. The same sort of substantial evidence review applies to the CAT determination. And again, the question is only, could the agency have reasonably reached the conclusion that it did? And because acquiescence is dispositive and because it is petitioner's burden, the absence of a report to police here is not some sort of additional requirement that the IJ or the board imposed on petitioner. It's a gap in evidence that ultimately means that he can't sustain his burden of proof. He has to establish a clear probability that it's more likely than not he will be singled out for torture, and that that torture will occur either by or with the acquiescence of the Honduran government. And here the agency reasonably concluded, particularly in light of the country conditions evidence that Judge Phipps mentioned, that petitioner's CAT claim fails at the acquiescence phase. As I think Judge Phipps is suggesting, the country conditions reports show that the government has responded with, quote, an iron fist security strategy to combat organized crime and gang activity. There was a pronounced effort to break up major cartels and gangs, and that they, quote, investigated and prosecuted many of the crimes that petitioner alleged happened in this case, and of course happens to thousands of other Hondurans sort of annually. And again, we come back only to the highly deferential substantial evidence standard. There is no legal error in the agency's analysis. The only question, and the you know, in the way that Ms. Kane presented it, is petitioner obviously disagrees with the result, but does the record compel a finding in his favor? And because the answer to that question is no, the court has no choice but to uphold the agency decision and deny the petition review on the merits. I recognize, Your Honor, that we didn't spend any time on the 1252B1 question when we talked about jurisdiction. I will only invite the court to ask questions if it has any about that. But other than that, we're comfortable with arguments in both our original answering brief and the supplemental brief, unless the court has additional questions.
Thank you, Mr. McManus. Ms. King?
Thank you, Your Honor. So I'd like to start with the idea that the family membership could not have been a but-for cause in this case. I think it definitely was a but-for cause of the targeting of him after he was beaten. So there are three separate incidents of harm in this case. The first was to the petitioner directly. The first was when he was initially beaten in 2008, 2009. That was when he was being targeted by gang members for recruitment. He was a young teenager at the time. In that case, certainly their express statements, as I stated before, were that he was being punished for failing to join the gang at that time. 3 to 4 years later, in 2012, he was targeted again after the gang became aware of him. They shot at him and threatened him with death. And he was actually shot at that time. 7 years later, after that, he returned to the country and was targeted again. He had not had any interactions with gang members at that time. He had not done anything at that time to draw their attention. They simply became aware that he was living in their area, went to his home, and attacked his partner who was living with him at the time. The idea that every single one of these incidents, the 5 years apart and 7 years later, were solely on account of him refusing to join the gang at one time in his youth, I think is just against the weight of the evidence. Their knowledge of him, their awareness of him as a person who was against them and who was because of his family membership. It's because his family stood out to them and was significant to them as people who had resisted their efforts in the past and people who had reported them to the police in the past. And I apologize. That's all I have time for.
Thank you, counsel. And Mr. Newman, thank you very much for your amicus and your pro bono work. Please extend our thanks to the members of your firm that supported your amicus brief. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So we will adjourn and we will circle back to you folks in the not too distant future. Thank you very much for joining us today.